1, I'm Greg, and I am an alcoholic. And I like to just first say that it's a real honor to be asked to speak at any meeting, but particularly this meeting. I have a lot of respect for this group and for what Sam, Billy, and other home group members have done for this group in this area, bringing in outside speakers and giving us a good, clean, clear AA message of experience, strength, and hope. And to me, it means a lot, and I do my best to be here on a regular basis. Let me just say, first of all, I do have a sobriety date. It's September 1st, 2001, and it wasn't my first sobriety date, but it's the one that I have now, and I hope and pray that it will not change going forward. But for today, I'm sober, and that's what counts. I have a sponsor, and I do sponsor other men. It's another important part of my sobriety, and I hope to get to that later. I grew up in Culpeper. I'm local, and grew up here in Culpeper. Pretty normal childhood. Nothing too major, nothing too earth-shattering or traumatic. It happened to me in my life. I had two pretty good parents, brought up in church, went to church, learned what I thought God was in church, would later change for me, and I would later turn my back on that person that I thought was God. And somewhere, I'd say I was pretty happy, I think. I was a pretty happy child. I was a very active child, overly active, always into mischievous, troubling type things. There's no shortage of trouble, even as a young child for me. And when I got to grade school, middle school, I always gravitated towards the people, the ones I thought were exciting. You know, those were typically the ones that were cutting up, acting out, getting in trouble, bad-mouthing the teacher, doing things in the bathroom at school they weren't supposed to be doing. And that was my crowd pretty quickly. And that's the type of people that I sought. And that part really doesn't change as my story goes on. But I, so I started off pretty early, I would say. I have an older sister. And so, I didn't identify with my peers. I identified with her peers. And she didn't like that, but I didn't give much regard to that. And so I established some connections with some people much older than myself. And I was thinking about it yesterday. I was kind of thinking about where it really took off for me, And it took off pretty quickly. I think I can remember one of the first times I drank was, I think I was 12 or 13. And I had this older cousin who was staying with us. And he was from Missouri, and he was 21. And so he was really cool. I'm not sure if he was cool or not, but to us, he was really cool. And, for a couple of favors and do some things for him, he would buy us a case of beer. And so I remember this one night in particular, he bought me and two friends of mine a case of beer, and I just could not wait until my parents would go to sleep. It was all I could think about. And then when they did, I don't know if it was 11 o'clock-ish maybe, I would think within an hour the case of beer was gone. And we had these little cups, and we were just Milwaukee's best, and we were just pouring it in and drinking it hot. And needless to say, that's when I had my first blackout. And I got a scar on my forehead from it still. I don't know. They told me the next day what had happened, because I didn't remember. And that part of my story didn't change much either. I had many occasions where people were telling me the day after what I had done the night before. And so from the very beginning, this is what people do when they drink alcohol. I had no other. My parents really didn't drink that much, I think I saw him have a couple glasses of wine, or my dad have a couple beers after he mows the lawn, or something like that. And, you know, I had heard rumor that my grandfathers, both of them, liked their whiskey. And my father's father was a very abusive alcoholic. I think that's the reason why my father, you know, he decided that he never wanted to be like his dad. You know, and I don't know if you feel that alcoholism is genetic or not. I feel it played a factor for me, probably, but also coupled with the environment that I put myself into, that time and time again, that repeated exposure of continuous, you know, excessive drinking. That coupled maybe with my predisposition, that's really probably what made me an alcoholic. And I don't blame anybody. There's nobody in my past that I can say is at fault for me being an alcoholic, you know, and I take full responsibility for that. And I knew pretty early, you know, the type of things I was doing was not normal. I knew at 15 years old, I was hanging out with these two guys, and at 15 years old, we would come home from school, we would get something to eat, go back, walk into the woods with a six-pack, or to start with, usually, of some Mickey's wide-mouth beer. And we'd climb up on the nearest log, laid over tree, and we'd sit there for hours. And I remember this one occasion where we got us a bottle of liquor somehow that day. And just kind of give you an understanding of how I was even at an early age, it was somewhere along our journey we lost the top, and there was no concern for anybody sitting on that log because we weren't going to need that again. You know, and that's the way we drank, and from the very beginning. And I mean, I can remember on more than one occasion taking the top, when you go to the liquor store, taking the top, throwing it out the window as a joke. We don't need that anymore, you know. And so that's kind of how I drank, and that's, you know, that's at 15, and it only really proceeded to get worse. You know, this is out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't talk about the other things that I did, but there was other mood-enhancing substances that I really liked as much as I did alcohol, and that, you know, I still believe that if I were only an alcoholic, maybe I wouldn't be standing here tonight. You know, those other things helped to really bring me to my knees. But how I know that I'm an alcoholic is it started with alcohol with me, and it ended with alcohol with me, and alcohol was always there for me, you know, and it was some, you know, there was some other things here and there along the way, and try this one, and don't like that one anymore, and I'll try this one, don't like that one anymore, and, you know, I would always be switching and trying to find the right combination of things to make me feel just right, and, you know, somewhere along the way, I got way out there. I kind of disconnected from, you know, what I hope my children will do. You know, I have children today, and what I want for them in life, and the way I want them to pursue their life. You know, my oldest is 14, so, you know, it brings me back to, I look at what she's doing and I compare it to what I'm doing. And although I tell her, I'm really hard on her for what she's doing, and it's nothing compared to what I've done. You know, it's kind of, in my mind, it's, you know, do as I say, not as I did. But I will not dare ever let her know that. You know, maybe when she's 20, we can sit down and we can talk about it. And now, last time I spoke, I have to say this, last time I spoke, I was really bothered by the fact I got asked to speak in Fredericksburg. And we thought that she was supposed to go with a friend of hers for the evening, and my wife and I, my sponsor and his wife, were going to go out to dinner in Fredericksburg and then speak at this meeting. And at the very last minute, her plans fell through. So she had to come with us. And it was an open meeting, of course, so that's not a problem, but, you know, it's really difficult for me to honestly share, like, where I've been to the extent of where I've been in front of her when I'm trying to tell her one thing over here, and my life, you know, the history of my life doesn't quite reflect what I'm trying to explain I want for her. And my only concern with that is not, you know, not that I want to be a hypocrite about that, but my only concern is that she's not able, as I wasn't at 14, 15, 16 years old, she's not able to make a good, sound judgment yet, I believe. You know, she doesn't have all the information. You know, I didn't get all the information until much later. You know, but at 15, you know, I knew everything, you know, and there's nothing you could tell me. I was very sure of what I was doing, and it's what I was supposed to be doing, and, you know, regardless of what others wanted me to do, it didn't matter. So, you know, I don't want her, hopefully she won't act out on those thoughts. I'm sure she has them, but hopefully she won't act out on them to the extent that I did. I've already had the experience of having her act out on some of her thoughts. So, anybody's a parent of teenage children, it's not easy. And it gives me new perspective now on the type of individual I was at 14, 15. I really feel for my parents today. It gives me a greater understanding of what that amends process to them also is really about. I heard it 1,000 times. My mom said, "I hope I live to see the day you have children of your own." You know, and now they live next door to me. So they get to see it all, my good times, my bad times, you know. And I live in a house full of four women and a female dog, female cat, and I'm really outnumbered. And sometimes I just go cry on my dad's shoulder, you know, figuratively, and he's just not very sympathetic at all. But I love him just the same. You know, and I want to talk about that a little bit later. That amends process has really brought us much closer. And I really want to try to focus on, you know, the gifts that AA has given me. But it's probably not in fairness to you guys until you know that I really am an alcoholic. So I have, in high school, I basically, those few scenarios I gave you of how I drank, that just continued. And drinking for me was a daily thing. I don't know if I started off alcoholic or not. Maybe I felt I could take it or leave it. I heard somebody say it the other night, and it pretty much described me. It was, I thought I could quit if I wanted to, I just didn't want to. You know, and so, you know, not in any situation did I ever think I want to quit. And so then it went from, it went through the years, and I became older, and I got my license, and got greater sense of independence, and, you know, I was doing things at 16, 17 that I pray my children don't do. You know, we were taking stateside road trips, you know, going 2-3 states away, you know, for weekends at a time, and I look back on it, I have no idea how my parents did not completely go insane wondering what their kid was up to. And, all I'll say about my sister is there was two of us. and if she chooses to tell you the other half of the story, she can. But so it continued, and it got progressive, and it got to the point where it was daily. And I would always do enough, though, I have to say, in school, I'd always do just enough to get by. I was really good at that. And somehow I knew where that bar was. You know, what's the minimum that I need to do to make me still look okay and to advance to the next level? You know, in this case, you know, to graduate to the next grade, or, you know, to not get, you know, kicked out of school, or not get my grades so low that dad's going to threaten to take the vehicle away from me or something like that. You know, I knew what I had to do, and so I did it. You know, and it's like, to me, the way I look at that today is, I was like, I was burning the candle at both ends. You know, because I had to expend extra energy over here in the daylight, you know, trying to do the right thing. You know, and then by night, I'm doing something else, you know. And as far as, you know, I require a lot more rest today than I did then. That's all I'll say. But it was not uncommon to come at home on a school night at 1 or 2 in the morning and you know, get 3 hours of sleep and get back up the next day and, you know, off to the races again. And that would just continue. And after I graduated high school, I went on to college, and I went to Blacksburg, Virginia Tech, eventually, and did a tenure at a community college, and got seasoned there, and then I went on to Virginia Tech, and you know, I was at that time, I realized that what the minimum thing for me to do was bartering and trading illegal substances. So that, for me, that was the minimum thing. That was the easier, softer way versus, you know, working a 9-to-5. Because I might have 40 hours to invest in a work week. You know what I mean? I got some partying that I need to do. And my emphasis was, all right, this weekend, what concert are we going to? You know, who's having get-together on Wednesday night? And then Wednesday night, it was, oh, well, whose house are we going to tomorrow night? You know, and it was daily. That's all I can say. And so I never, from the beginning, I never knew anything like what people consider normal drinking or social drinking. And social drinking is when you go out with your friends, you know, and everybody gets hammered. You know, that was social drinking for me. So in college, I really was able to excel at this. In college, I learned a new art form. It's called binge drinking, where you would maybe not drink Monday, Tuesdays, sometimes Wednesday, maybe or maybe not, and then just pound it for like four or five straight days afterward, from like Tuesday night or Wednesday, and you could kind of just coast through Wednesday and Thursday classes, you know. And I never scheduled any classes for Friday. Never scheduled any classes before like 10 a.m. anyway, so because that would interfere with the nightlife. And in the end, where this all kind of came to a head for me was I was a junior in college. It's 1999. And these other activities I was doing caught up with me. And I received a knock on the door, and it was about 15 officers in uniform. It was a full-on raid by the Montgomery County Drug Task Force. And I was the subject. And I had what they were looking for. And things kind of just turned dim from there. And, man, I knew my walls came crashing in on me at that moment. The gig was up. And up to that point, I had to say, you know, I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. I was untouchable, you know. I mean, I had friends in every corner. People loved me. I was doing people favors here and there and everywhere. I could get done things I needed to do, and I had no problems, really. And I had to say, my life at that time, I thought it was a lot of fun. You know, and I thought it was kind of like it was surreal. It was kind of like the life of a rock star, you know. I was walking around and closet full of new clothes and big parties and stocked liquor cabinets. And, you know, my roommate was a bartender. That made sense, because after hours was at my house from 2 to 6 in the morning or whenever we all passed out. And, you know, I don't think I ever really, like, quitting drinking really for me was just like either you run out of alcohol or you pass out. It's kind of whichever happens first, you know, and that's really the way I drank. And so back to this day, February 10th, 1999, not a day I don't think I'll ever forget. I'm sitting there, and my walls have just crashed, and it's, you know, it's, wow, I don't really know. I'm really actually grateful today that I was supervised during that whole time, because my thinking was really insane, like taking my life or, you know, I knew at that time there were some guns in the house, too. I had gotten involved with some rather shady individuals and was carrying guns on a regular basis. And I knew at that time when they came in where the guns were, and it even crossed my mind, you know. And, you know, from where I grew up and where I started with a simple, you know, taking a drink with my buddies, you know, to have a good time, to where I had come, you know, 14 years later, I don't even know how I got there. I have no idea. And, you know, I know when they say that, you know, things are progressive, this disease is progressive, and, you know, we warn our children that, you know, don't do these things. These are the gateway substances that lead you to other things. I realize there's truth in all that, you know, and I can see it in my own experience, you know. I don't know how I got from A to over here at the ending point. And unfortunately, that wasn't the end. You know, if it had stopped there, you know, maybe I could have saved myself a few years of hardship. But that just went on, and because I had a lot of money with the activities I was engaged in, I did what anybody in my position would do. So I went and hired two of the very best lawyers in the area. You know, a judge's son and an older guy had been in the county for 40 years practicing law. And my best thinking was, I got to beat these charges. You know what I mean? I was not a bit more remorseful of what I had done. You know, when I was sitting there that day in that chair and I was surrounded and they were grilling me and, you know, asking me all these questions, I was really sorry. You know, and at that moment, I really meant it. You know, but once I made bond, I had forgotten all about those thoughts. You know, they had completely left me, you know, and it wasn't really intentional. It's just the way I think. And I guess it's just selfish, call it selfishness, self-centeredness, whatever. But I was bonded. And somehow or another, we struck this deal to drag out the process. And I know today is the grace of God that actually allowed that to transpire. No doubt in my mind, because at that time, I attributed to having a couple good lawyers and paying a lot of money. And I know the judge is playing golf with the lawyer and he's losing $1,000 a hole or whatever he was doing, you know. That's what was my thinking, you know. That's the way our legal system worked, you know. And maybe it does, I don't know. But I was able to continue this thing out so that I could finish my schooling, which is... I mean, I was going after an engineering degree. At that point in time, somehow or another, I actually kind of got a game plan about life. I was pursuing an engineering degree. I was making good grades. I had made the dean's list a couple of years. And I was doing this all there by night. I was totally living this alter ego lifestyle. And I was going to school over here and... You know, I was in the Aerospace Ocean Engineering Department, and you know, my best friend was his design project was designing a satellite for NASA, and by night we were, you know, boozing it up, you know, carrying on with everything under the sun, and it was totally Jekyll and Hyde, like the big book talks about. I was definitely two different people, you know, and it was just... It was trying to hit that minimum bar, you know what I mean? But I had such high standards of the lifestyle that I was living that I knew I couldn't go for a lowly job. I had to go for... I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. That's what I was pursuing at the time. And you know, long story short is that I made it through that. And the only real sufferer that I, you know, the only real penalty that I suffered is I was actually pursuing two degrees, one as an aerospace, one as an ocean engineer, dual degrees, and I had to drop one of them. I had to drop the aerospace program because I just couldn't take it. I was going insane. I was literally losing my mind. These charges were facing me. I was facing 6 to 33 years. And my lawyer told me, in spite of the fact that I gave him a lot of money, that his exact words were, they want some blood, and which meant they wanted some time. They wanted me to do some time. And so now I had another decision to make. You know, it's like, I didn't know exactly what that meant, but 5 years sounded like a long time. And I don't know, I'm not a real big guy, so I'm not sure I'm prison material. And that was my biggest concern right there. You know, you see a lot of horror movies, some bad things happen on some of those movies about prison. And I had this bad idea of what could happen to me when I would go down the road. And, you know, he ended up cutting this deal where, because I had never been in trouble and, you know, was trying to do the right thing as far as going to school goes, ended up cutting this deal where I could do this boot camp program. But the mistake they made is they let me back out on bond. Now, had they kept me and then just sent me through this 20-week boot camp program, I've been all right. But they let me back out on bond for 2 weeks. So my best thinking was, you know, I'm going away for 20 weeks. I mean, this is like the end of my life. You know, a month ago I was facing 33 years. You know, now they're basically telling me, okay, here you can do 20 weeks. You know, so I really got spared, and I couldn't even do that because I had 2 weeks, and in my mind, that 20 weeks was a long time, so I needed to. It started off like this. Well, it was a Thursday or Friday when I got out of court, and it started off sound something like this. Okay, well, I've got 15 days, okay, so I'm just going to drink this weekend. You know, that's it. And then some other things, and now I'm drinking, and now it's Monday, and it's like, well, I got 12 days. I got plenty of time to clean out my system, clean up, you know, be ready in 2 weeks. All right. Well, it's next weekend. I still got 7 days. It's not a big deal. And the night before I had to turn myself in, Saturday night, I'm at Nissan Pavilion, an AC/DC concert on the front row, doing things I shouldn't be doing with people I shouldn't be with. And end result was I showed up at jail, was dirty, and they took me to this boot camp, and I was there for 2 weeks, and I was excelling. You know, I was top of my class. You know, I was carrying the colors. I was calling the cadence. You know, I was the guy, you know. And then they came and got me. They're like, okay, we got a problem. You show up here, you're dirty, and you were on probation when you got here. So your probation, the judge has revoked your sentence, and he gave me 5 years, but he was suspended if I'd do this 20 weeks. And so basically what I thought was I'm going to be busy for the next 5 years. That's what was going through my mind. And it put me in this hole in a solitary confinement. I was there like 2 days, and I couldn't eat. I was a wreck. I was depressed, and I couldn't eat. And this guy came to me. This guard. He came to the little food portal there, and they've been putting my food in. I've been kicking it out. You know, and I told him I don't want it. I'm good, thanks. And he came to me, and he said. And I don't even remember what this guy looks like, but I remember his voice, and I remember it like it was yesterday. He said, "Son, I'm worried about you." He said, "You need to eat." And I said, "I can't eat. You know, I'm a wreck. I can't eat." And he said, "Well, do you believe in God?" And it was kind of like I hadn't pondered that thought for a long time. You know what I mean? That thought had never entered my mind. It was me against the world. And I said, I guess I do. You know, I kind of went back to that childhood picture of who I thought God was. I knew, you know, going all the way back there, I knew God existed in my mind. I said, yeah, I guess I do. And he said, well, if you believe in God, now might be a good time to say a little prayer. And, I don't know, something washed over me when he said that. Those words, like, hit me like a ton of bricks. And when he just kind of shut the door and went on his way, and when he did, man, I just fell apart. And I cried like a baby, and I hit my knees, and turned around on that concrete floor, and looking up at that little window, it's about like this, and I just said, God help me. That's all I could get out of my mouth. And I believe to this day, probably one of the most honest, heartfelt prayers that I've ever said in my lifetime, you know. And God would help me, but it wouldn't be in my timeline. You know, and I'm all right with that today, but I wasn't all right with that then. And I had to go through some things. I ended up serving a year in the penitentiary system. And most of that was done at the county jail level, and then I'd spent about 100 days at a minimum security penitentiary. And it's not like you see in the movies, and I'm still the same man I was when I went in there. It's not an experience I wish to repeat, you know. In there, it's very different. You fight for everything you own. I remember having to challenge people three times my size just so that I was concerned that if I gave in, that they would be taking my lunch on a daily basis. You know, and I mean, that's the kind of things that you're subjected to in that environment. And it definitely helped. It got my attention, I'll say. And so when I came out, when I finally did get out, you know, I had this plan. I was thinking all along that it was these other things that really was dragging me down, these other substances. It wasn't alcohol. So I'm not really an alcoholic. I got a problem selling these things, doing these other things. And so I decided that I was going to stick to the alcohol-only plan. And I had a couple of buddies come pick me up. We went to the restaurant that I had planned that we would go to a month before my release date. And I consumed about as many beers as I planned I would consume of the alcohol that I knew I wanted to drink. I had lived this out. I had this one coming. This was 11 months, you know, in the working. And when I did, I thought 11 months without a drink, you know, two beers is really going to tear me up, is what I thought. And this is when I really had my first encounter with the progressive nature of alcoholism itself, because I got out, and it was like I never stopped. I had these two beers and did nothing. And then I had another, and it was not much more effect. And then it was another and another. And, you know, after 30 days being out, I'm telling myself, you know, of straight drinking, you know, 12-pack a day or more, liquor and whatever. And I was telling myself, all right, today I'm not going to drink. And I made it to like 6 o'clock at night. And when you know, it was Sunday night, it was summer, hot summer night, I'm hanging out with the fellas, and I just happen to be sitting on that cooler. They keep asking me to get up to hand them a beer, you know. And after doing that about three or four times, you know, the natural motion's not like this. You know, the natural motion's like this. And so I said, F it, give me one. You know, and then that was another, then another, then another. 3 o'clock in the morning, we're leaving Charlottesville. I'm driving. No headlights, blue lights behind me. You know, here we go again. And that really is what brought me to AA. And, you know, I don't think, you know, it used to say the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. I'm glad they took that out, because I didn't have that when I got here. What I had was an honest desire to quit receiving those pieces of paper that said Commonwealth of Virginia versus Greg Hoffman. That was a problem. You know what I mean? The drinking, that wasn't the problem. That was my solution. You know, that's the only thing I had that was getting me through all this stuff. It was my, you know, my fix-all, my cure-all. And so I went and talked to this guy after I got out the jail, and I woke up to the guy swinging me around the drunk tank on my mattress. This big guy, about 6'5", 300 pounds. He had my mattress with me on it, swinging me around. He was going off. He had some kind of issue with the guards, and he was using me as a weapon. And you know, I came to, and I'm like, holy, here I am. You know, looking at the inside of the bars again. And this isn't even 30 days. It's like 28 days or 29 days after I got it the first time. And so that led me to AA. And how it led me is I basically was in like just a two-day depression. You know, I did what I heard somebody say the other night. I hear it all the time. I did what any good alcoholic would do. I called Mom. I asked her if I could come sleep on her sofa. And I had nothing. Absolutely nothing. I had this college degree I worked really hard to get. Meant nothing because of my history, my record, and all that. I was worthless, useless, irresponsible, dishonest, all these things. And now, on top of that, the only chance I had was shattered. Because when I was in jail, I've met some pretty good guys, and we had some conversations about God, and we talked a lot about God. And in my heart, I really wanted to do the right thing. Somewhere inside of me, you know, I know the difference between right and wrong, always have, and I really wanted to do the right thing. I just had no tools, no sort of toolbox whatsoever. And so I was destined to fail when I got back out, you know, and go back into the same environment that I was in. I'm guaranteed to fail, guaranteed to fail. And I did. And so I called this guy out of desperation. I knew that I felt I had to tell the probation people before they found out. And so when I did, they put me in contact with this guy, a substance abuse specialist within their office. And I went there, and for whatever reason, not knowing this guy, I told this guy my whole story. It was like an hour, you know what I mean? I did like a fifth step with this guy or something, you know? And when I got done, I thought he was going to say, stand up, turn around, put the handcuffs on me. And he just shook his head. He said, I understand. He said, I know right where you are. And he proceeded to tell me that he'd been there before and that he was 19 years sober in a program by Alcoholics Anonymous, and that he was going to help me. And I mean, you know, again, God, you know, we have this saying, you know, God doing for me what I cannot do for myself. You know, God's really taking care of me, you know, even when I didn't think he was taking care of me. You know, even when I wasn't even asking for help, you know, I was being taken care of. And I didn't come in here thinking that. That's something that I've learned after being here for a while. It took me a while to recognize and admit that fact, because I still thought I was all powerful, you know. And so I told him, he said, well, would you go to an AA meeting? I said, yeah, I'll go to an AA meeting. How about a 28-day treatment program? And I must have stuttered or something. He said, oh, you're not that bad, are you? And what I heard him say was, if you don't do what I suggest, you're going back to jail. I don't think that's what he said, but that's what I heard. And so I said, yeah, I'll go. Of course I'll go. Yeah. And so he signed me up for Boxwood, and I went through Boxwood. And I came into AA on August 1st, 2001, and didn't have a sponsor, and was going to a meeting a day. And the meeting, I was staying with my mom and dad, and the meeting's a half a mile from their house. They have meetings 5 days a week there. So I was walking up to the church there in Culpeper, and I didn't want to know anybody, you know what I mean? I was there on my own accord, and, you know, I didn't want anybody to know me. I don't know what I was doing. I was confused and lost. And I would show up, and then finally this lady, Melissa, she started talking to me after the meeting, and she's trying to pull some information out of me, you know what I mean? I knew what she was doing, you know what I'm saying? I didn't really want to tell her too much, you know what I mean? And I didn't tell AA nothing about me for several months, you know what I mean? I'm sure in the beginning, I think most people thought I was another high-bottom case of alcoholism, because I told them very little. And then I remember the night that I actually started going to this group regularly. It became my first home group, and started going there regularly. And I remember the night that at about 3 months sober or whatever, after going there and getting to know all these faces on a first-name basis, I remember the night that I went there, and it was really bothering me, and I just dropped it all on the table, you know, and I told them, like, everything, the whole story. I was facing going back to jail, and I was really afraid, and all this, that, and the other. And I remember going from the high bottom case at the end of the table to people looking at me like, oh, I'm glad I'm not that bad, you know. At least that's what I perceived, you know. They were kind of looking at me like, jeez, you know, you got it rough, buddy. And that was my perception, which is not always the best. But so eventually, you know, talking, what happened in that first 30 days is I would stay sober like 7 days in the beginning, And then I felt pretty good on day 8. I felt, look what I've done. I stayed sober 7 whole days. And so as I'm patting myself on the back with this hand, I'm taking a drink off of a beer with the other hand. And somewhere, they say around here, a hip full of AA and a belly full of beer doesn't mix too well. And I, after doing this 2 or 3 times in that first 30 days, it got to the point at the very end, my last drink was pathetic. It was. My best thinking was, I'm going to go, ironically, I went back to the same pub, nightclub down in Charlottesville that got me 30 days before. I went down there, and this time it was different. Because I was going down there at 5 p.m., and I was going to get there early. I was going to get hammered for about an hour or two. I was going to stop drinking. I was going to wait 4 or 5 hours, and I was going to drive home. So I had a solution. I had it figured out. You know what I mean? I got this. And something happened. That's all I can tell you. Just the grace of God, I suppose, as best I can say, is I found myself at 12:30 at night, holding the first beer, looking at it, it was half full, and I was like, I was disgusted. I was really disgusted then. It was like, man, I can't even get drunk right anymore, I'm really screwing up here. I threw that away and drove home, and the next day I went to AA, and it just happened to be September 1st, and of 2001, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since. And what changed after going back to AA, what changed for me is I listened to Melissa. She was telling me, what she was telling me was, get a sponsor. You need a sponsor. What are you doing? Get a sponsor. Got a sponsor yet? Day 3. Got a sponsor yet? Day 4. Got a sponsor yet? And finally, out of necessity, about a week later, maybe she'd shut up, if nothing else. I got a sponsor. And I'd never seen this guy before, and little did I know, This guy was like a big book thumper. You know what I'm saying? He knew all about the steps, and he was telling me some things that I hadn't heard in 45 days of going to AA around Culpeper. You know what I mean? And then he would always back it up with, "Well, I only know how to get sober one way, and that's the way I got sober. And if you don't like that, then you can go find another sponsor. That's fine with me. Don't waste my time." You know, I was like, "Well, hey, this guy's not very nice," And I mean, they'd tell me that, him and the other older guys that he hung out with, they'd tell me to shut up and sit in the back. You get in the back. No, you're not sitting up front. You get in the back. And then, I went to meetings, and they would tell me things like, "If we want to hear about getting drunk, we'll ask you. Until then, you just listen." And that's what I needed to hear. Everybody's perhaps different, and I'm sure there's as many different people in this room as there are people sitting here, but everybody's different in how they hear things and how they need to hear things, and I feel that God put me in touch with this person because that's what I needed to hear. I am a hard-headed, belligerent, know-it-all alcoholic. I already know the answer. Most of the time I could finish your sentence for you. And he knew that about me. And I guess they say you spot it, you got it. I come to find out later, maybe he was more like me than I thought he wasn't in the beginning. And we proceeded on this journey. We walked through the steps. And he was taking me. I was on a step a month program. And I came out of Boxwood, after October 1st or what have you. And I said, I told him, I said, I've been looking at these steps, in Boxwood. We've been talking about them a lot. I said, I understand them pretty well now. I said, I think I'm on step 3. He said, "No, you're not. You're on step 1. We argued about that for a while. And then we went to step 1. And we started with step 1, and he explained to me, you might be on step 3, but as your sponsor, I need to know about you. I need to hear about your first step, and I need to hear about your second step, your belief of God, your insanity in your life, so that I can help you." And he explained to me, "How can I help you with your problem if I don't know what your problem is?" And so when we got to the third step, just so happened I was going through those court trials with the DUI and the probation violation and all these things going on at about 3 or 4 months sober, and I had a good opportunity to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I didn't view it as that at the time, but he put me in contact. He knew what he was doing. He put me in contact with this guy who had been through almost exactly the situation I was going through. And that guy explained to me how, regardless of the outcome of my situation, that everything was going to be all right. And, you know, he didn't just leave me with that information and walk away from me, but between him and my sponsor, they double-teamed me, and they called me, you know, daily. You know, I mean, I was going to 15 meetings a week. I was a pretty desperate way. You know what I mean? I was hurting. I was afraid. I didn't want to go back to jail for another 5 years, 4 years, whatever time I had left. And I was willing at that point in time. That's why I say, you know, I don't know. It took me a while to see how the drinking was really related to my problems, the problems of my life. But I was willing for these problems to go away and do whatever it took to get them to go away. And so that's what I did. And we just proceeded, you know, and he used that against me. And he would just beat me and say, "You want to drink again? You're going to die. You drink, you're going to die." You know, he would yell at me, and "If you don't do this four step, you're going to die." You know, and you know what? He's right. You know what I mean? I mean, I probably wasn't going to drop dead from a heart attack by not doing the four step, but eventually what I found out is without completing these steps that eventually I was going to be the same person left with no toolbox again, and my only weapon of defense was to pick up that drink. And once I picked up that drink, that would set in motion another turn of events, and eventually, whether it be a month, a week, or 10 years from now, it was going to kill me, you know, by my own hand or by some tragic event or any of the other ways that alcohol takes people out of this world. And so for me, the process through the steps was more out of necessity than it was out of desire, you know. I didn't see the light at the end of the tunnel for a very long time. And, I just did what he said. He showed me we got the third step. It says in the big book, "Having made this decision, we launched into a vigorous course of action." And he turned and looked at me and he said, "Does that sound like they're sitting around waiting?" I said, "Okay." And I got my piece of paper out and I went home. And, you know, a couple days later, I had my fourth step done. And then I had to turn myself in to jail and for these charges. I got convicted of this DUI and this probation violation. I had to go back in front of the judge and I had to turn myself in. And he said, "We've got to go do the fifth step now." And little did I know, he really believed that I was going away for 4 months. And he felt that if he just left me with that fourth step knowledge without doing the fifth step, that it could have some damaging effect to me long term. And so, you know, I appreciate that he did that for me. And we got together, and 3 hours later, as I only had like about 4 hours, and 3 hours later we had done the fifth step, and we prayed together, and I just felt like this relief, you know, like this burden had been lifted from me. And I had my mother and my father, they drove me, it was a 3 hour drive to turn myself in. And, you know, it talks about in the big book, it's in the big book, it talks about after the fifth step, we retreat to a quiet place and we spend some time to reflect on what we've done, you know. And I didn't do that intentionally, but this drive, this three-hour drive, I sat in the back seat of this car, and I don't think there was hardly a word spoken. And I just looking back on it, you know, I reflected. I had no choice. It was fresh in my mind. And as a result of that, when I got out of that car, I remember turning and looking at my mom, and they looked concerned. You know, like this is maybe the last time they're going to see me free for a few years. And I remember telling them it's going to be all right. And believing it, not just mouthing the words, but I really believed that everything was going to be all right. And I had taken that knowledge of that third step, and I was carrying it with me. you know, that even if I had to go in front of that judge and, you know, if I had to spend the next 4 years of my life behind bars, I felt at that moment that everything was going to be all right. And I went in there, and those guys, they said, oh, you've done it now. You've had it. You know, this guy, he doesn't like it when you do this, that, and the other. He's going to fry you. And I just, a whole weekend, they couldn't touch me. But everything's going to be all right. I ain't worried about it, guys. I'm not worried about it. And they're like, you're crazy. You're stupid. You know, come Monday, they let me go. And it's because of AA. And basically what happened was, he said he was going to give me a continuance for 3 months. And I show back up 3 months later with two rows, and the courthouse packed full of AAs. And my lawyer's like, with all those people that are here to testify on behalf of Greg's character, please stand up. And two rows in the courthouse stood up. I think the judge got the message. You know what I mean? And what I told him was, and the Commonwealth attorney, he said, well, sounds, Mr. Huff. I told him, I'm really sorry for what I've done. I stood there in front of them and told them, I'm here to pay my penance. Here I am. I've done the crime. I can't deny it. And what you see fit with me to do with me is what I'm prepared to do. And, I just want to say that, you know, I have a job today. I've been sober 5.5 months. I'm happy. You know, I don't want to drink. And for the first time in my life, I've found a way of living that I'm enjoying. And, the Commonwealth attorney, he stands up and he pulls out my testimony from 1 year before and reads it back to the courtroom. And it's almost verbatim. And I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no. And the judge was just kind of like, you know, looking over his glasses at me like, what do you got to say for this? And I just, you know, I was talking with the guy's sponsor yesterday who's going, he's really concerned because he's going for this new job interview. And he was very honest with his current employer. And he's concerned that, you know, if he's real honest with the new employer, that, you know, it could ultimately mean that he doesn't get the job. And he says, what I do? And all I could share with him was that moment that I was sitting right there in that courtroom, and I just looked right dead in that judge's eyes, and I told him, I said, listen, here's how it is. I said, when I was sitting here before you a year ago, I said all those things, and I meant every one of them. I said, the difference between then and today is I have a program today. I have Alcoholics Anonymous for me working in my life that allows me to not take a drink if I don't want to drink. You know, and this is working for me. This is the first time ever in my life that I've been a period of 5 months without a drink. And, I'm running out of time. Long and short is, they pretty much let me go. They gave me 15 days. I went back and I served 15 days, and they gave me weekends. I'm just like, I want to get it over with. I went down there, turned myself in, did 2 weeks, and came home. Worst 2 weeks of my life. Those 2 weeks in jail were longer than the year I spent in jail. And the difference is I wasn't buying what they were selling. You know, and when I was there before, it was the man, and I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then when I was sitting there that 2 weeks, it was me. It was me. And I was listening to all of them talk about them, and I was thinking about me. And, it was a big difference for me, and it made the experience kind of miserable. But what's happened to me, just real quickly, as I am about out of time, but what's happened to me in AA is, a lot of things have happened to me materially. That sponsor, I went to work for that sponsor. And 5 years later, as a result, I had a very good career from it, managing as the general manager of his business. And I've used that to gain a new position for a company, a director position for a global company. It's a lot of responsibility. I have a wife I found, an old friend we reacquainted. And it's the love of my lifetime. She's my best friend, hands down. Her spirituality matches mine. She's she's more spiritual than I am. And the joke in the beginning was that she must be a saint to fool around with a guy like me. But having been to a couple of Al-Anon meetings and talking to a couple of Al-Anons, I now know that maybe she's sicker than I am to be with me. That's kind of the joke. So, and she laughs about it, so it's all right that I tell that. And we have three beautiful daughters. And life today, I couldn't stand here and put in 50 minutes of time all the things that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. When I got to that amends, I made all my amends. I covered my past relationships. And the best thing that really happened out of that is, I tell guys about making amends.